Okay, we'll start with our blessing here. All right. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah. Today we will do our learning in the honor and the merit of the Jewish people and the success of our soldiers in Israel to be able to neutralize and destroy the tunnels that are being used to infiltrate Israel to cause death and destruction, and to pray also for peace, that people who are innocent should not be used by their governments as human shields, and to turn the world back right side up where they are not accusing Israel of grotesque, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, that this war is cruel and outrageous because of the way the other side is behaving. It's just beyond human comprehension, and the fact that the rest of the world just swallows it hook, line, and sinker is really, really, really unbelievable. So we should not suffer from, I think, what's it called, the Stockholm Syndrome, where the people who are the victims start believing that the captors are right, and they get their minds twisted around. So it's one thing for people in the Arab countries, they have their own agenda, but when you see the rest of the world following suit, it is really very frightening. So we are at a very precarious time, and having it be during the 3 weeks that we are now in the process of observing, which is between the time of the 17th of Tammuz, which was a couple weeks ago, and Tisha B'Av, the destruction of the temple, which we will commemorate on Tisha B'Av, which will be the week after. So when we will be commemorating that. So it is a serious time. And in this time, people also become a little bit more looking for signs, like, is redemption coming? So the Jewish people always have their eyes open, looking for redemption, especially in times that are difficult. And we are at that place. And I've been starting to see emails of, like, Mashiach is coming now, this has to be the time. There have been other times when we have thought that also, but the work seems to be almost done. We almost seem to be somehow coming to the end. The ancient rabbis said that they were eager for Mashiach to come, but they didn't want to live through the time of the coming because of the difficulties that would be involved, that it was going to be very, very challenging. That being said, the Jewish people is unbelievable and amazing. I don't know how many of you saw that there was a lone soldier, which means an American who made Aliyah, became Israeli, went into IDF, was killed. There were 30,000 people who came to his funeral. And I didn't have to be, like, quite a dignitary to have something like that happen here in the United States. So he was not a lone soldier at all, but embraced by the entire Jewish people of all stripes. And at the funeral, they had to turn the cars away because there was no room on the road for people to get to the funeral. So there's no telling how many people would have been there. So we are taking every single injury, every single death is really striking us very, very personally. As we take everything that happens to the Jewish people personally, this is our family. So speaking of our family, we're going to the Torah portion this week, which is Parshat Maaseh on page 919. Did anybody watch the two videos from Rabbi David Foreman about Parshat Matot Maaseh here? Okay, good, because I'm going to try to give this over. Rabbi David Foreman had a video, Divrei Torah, about last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha, because this Parsha, even though we still have the book of Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy to finish, this week's Parsha is really the end of the Torah. And it really doesn't strike us as that because we still have the book of Devarim to go to. And it's like, wait, this isn't Simchas Torah. This isn't the end of the Torah. What are we saying? This is the end. But this is the end of the book of Bamidbar. And the entire book of Deuteronomy, the entire book of Devarim, is really Moshe's farewell speech that he gives right before he dies. It's a recapitulation of everything that has happened over the last 40 years. Because we're now in the end, we're here now at the end of the 40th year. The story is almost done. And Moshe's going to give his farewell speech. He's going to inspire the Jewish people. He's going to direct them, teach them, re-energize them, refocus them, and that is the entire book of Deuteronomy. But if we look at what happens in the Torah, the end of the story of the Torah is this week's Parsha. So when we come to the end, we'd say, like, if we're coming to the end of the Parsha, it doesn't really seem like so much happens. And primarily, even in this week's Parsha, if you look at page 919, the reason it's called Parsha Maaseh is the word Maaseh means journeys. These are the journeys of the Jewish people. And Moshe is going to go through and he's going to recount all of the different encampments that the Jewish people were at over the past, during the past 40 years, because each of those encampments represents a spiritual curriculum goalpost for the Jewish people. And the names of the places refer to spiritual challenges, spiritual accomplishments that the Jewish people achieved or were encountered as they were going along that journey. So that's what the beginning of Parsha Maaseh goes through. And you can see on page 919, if you just want to look at it. Yes, Marcia. Okay, sure, I will be happy to reiterate that because it's a little counterintuitive. Okay, so if you look on page 919, we see all the journeys, and you go on to page 921, and you'll see the journey list continues. They journeyed from here, they encamped there. They journeyed from here, they encamped there. And each of these places is the executive summary of all of the encampments. And then if you look on page 921 at the bottom of that page, verse 50, then Moshe is going to go ahead and start talking about directions for after they cross the Jordan River. So let's just take a look at that a moment, verse 50 and 51. Marcia, in fact, why don't you read that for us? It might help a little bit. Is that okay? Okay, that's okay. That's all right. Susan, oh, you don't have a permission for you. Who would like to read verses 50? Yes, please. Verses 50 and 51 on the bottom of page 921.
Hashem spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab, by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, and you shall destroy all their prostration stones. All their molten images shall you destroy."
Okay, actually you can stop there. So clearly what's being given is these are directions for when they go into the land of Israel. After you cross the Jordan, this is what you're going to do. Chapter 34, and you can see there's a map, is going to give the boundaries of the land of Israel. So you can see the map there on the page bottom of page 923. It tells exactly where the boundaries are of the land of Israel. These are things that you tell people as they're getting ready to go into the land. These are like your marching orders as they're about ready to go in. It talks about how the land will be divided, exactly what the borders are going to be, and for each of, and what the leadership's going to be. Then on page 927, it talks about the cities for the Levites, and you can see again the map. This is like the city planning map. And the bottom of page 927, it talks about where the Levite city is, the open area. This is the early good urban planning. You had to have open area. Then you had a place where there were the fields and vineyards and areas where you couldn't have just wall-to-wall people. Basically, it had to have good urban planning. So this, again, is information about the cities for the Levites. Then you turn to page 929, and it talks about, you can just see in the margin there, it's talking about the cities of refuge for unintentional murder, that's part of the setup for the maintenance of the holiness of the camp and the social construct of the camp, of the Jewish people, of how the cities of refuge are to be set up also in the land of Israel. So basically, all of this is discussion about what's going to happen once they get into the land of Israel. Okay, so then that is basically Parshat Maaseh, and then the last thing that happens is going to be a discussion about inheritance of the tribes. So let's take a look at that. But before we do, I just want to reiterate how we're at the end to address Marcia's question about being at the end of the Torah. So the Torah, which we know started in Bereshit with creation, goes all the way through the 40 years in the desert of the Jewish people's, I won't say wandering because it makes it sound like they didn't know what they were doing or where they were going. And they did. There was a planned curriculum. Even though they didn't know about it ahead of time, it was God's curriculum, a 40-year planned curriculum before they would cross into the Jordan. We remember that the reason they were there for 40 years was as a result of the sin of the spies giving the evil report about the land of Israel and the Jewish people, the Jewish men's hesitation. Let's go back to Egypt. We can't go into the land. It's the people there are too barbarous. They'll destroy us, destroy our children. Why did you bring us here to die? And God is like, if you don't have trust and faith in the going into the land of Israel, then you're going to spend 40 years in the Midbar, and the next generation will go into the land of Israel, not you. And all of the men from the ages of 20 to 60 at the time of leaving Egypt all died in the desert until there was a new generation that rose up. The Torah itself is not a history book because it skips in narrative 38 years. We hear about year 1 and 2, and then we jump to year 40. And year 40 were the past number of Parshas that we've had were year 40, and now Parshat Maaseh is the end of that time. It's going to be the last month of Moshe's life, and he's going to give a one-month-long discourse on what to tell the Jewish people. That will be the entire book of Deuteronomy, and then the Torah ends. But as far as the story, as far as the narrative ends right here. Is that a little clearer? So it's kind of strange. That isn't true. It would have made sense. The sin of the golden calf, that was forgiven on Yom Kippur. Because the sin of the golden calf happened when Moshe was supposed to come down with the tablets. Instead, they were worshiping the golden calf. Moshe goes back up to Mount Sinai, gets forgiveness from God, goes back up again, another 40 days, another 40 days, another 40 days. This is a total of 120 days. Goes back up and comes down with the second set of tablets, and that's on Yom Kippur, the 10th of Tishrei, with full forgiveness for the sin of the golden calf at that time. However, it would be correct to say that all sins that the Jewish people commit are all like a little bit of the golden calf in them. But it wasn't the nail in the coffin. The sin of the spies, that was the nail in the coffin of the Jewish people. That's what directly results in the 38 years. It's really a 40-year sentence with 2 years off for time already in the desert. So that's really what it is. Because what God says is, 1 year for every day that the spies were in the land of Israel. They were in the land of Israel for 40 days and 40 nights. God says, for 1 year for every day the spies were in there, and that's how long you're going to be in the desert. And it wasn't just time out. It was supposed to be because God isn't vindictive. God isn't punitive. God is a teacher. So the time of the 38 years in the desert was for instructive purposes, like clearly you're not ready and we need to correct the problem. And that's good discipline, is when you correct the problem so the people are ready to go in. Because it doesn't do God any good to have people who are not ready to go into the land of Israel go into the land of Israel. That will be a disaster for everybody. It's not worthwhile. It's like, again, putting somebody ahead in school into a grade where they don't have the skills to go into that next level. You don't do anybody any favors, the teacher, the student, nobody. So God's like, okay, we're going to stay in the Midbar, and we will midaber, we will speak. We will speak about what it is you need to learn over those 40 years. And that's what happened. So we pick it up at the end when they're getting ready to cross into the Jordan. So you could say, so you would expect, after everything the Torah covers, some pretty big drama, starting from creation, and then we have the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, and we have, you know, the story of Babel, and we have the flood, and we have being slaves in Egypt, and we have the plagues and the splitting of the sea. We have standing at Mount Sinai. We have the sin of the golden calf. We have the sin of the spies. We have some great movie material. So we have a lot of drama going on. One would expect that at the end of the narrative of the Torah, there would be a big something a big something to culminate what was this whole saga about. The saga is only for the purposes of instruction. It is not history. Yes, it contains historical information, but it is not for historical purposes. It is for instruction in living. So at the end of Maaseh, we find, and let's read the conclusion, because that basically is going to be the end. And because it's the end of the book of Bamidbar, which we would say at the end of any of the books, but the end of the book of Bamidbar, and as we're saying, the end really of the narrative of the 40 years, we always say, Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek. We say, be strong, and may we be strengthened. Certainly those are compelling, rallying words for the Jewish people today, meaning this moment, is Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek, and may we be strengthened. And may we strengthen one another, and may we be strengthened by the strength of one another. So all of that is implied in Venit Chazek, and we shall be strengthened. So this is what we're going to see at the end of this book. So everyone get ready for the big finale, and let's take a look on page 935. And we're going to read verses 10 through 12. Janice, would you like to read that for us, please?
As Hashem commanded Moses, so did the daughters of
Zelophehad.
Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, became wives to sons of their uncles, to cousins from the families of the children of Manasseh, son of Joseph. Did they become wives, and their inheritance remained within the tribe of the family of their father.
Okay. No one's clapping. No one's standing up. Where's the ovation? This is the end of the Torah. Okay, this is the end. And then, hooray! What just happened here? Okay, this was like the best ending ever. So what was it? What was this ending? And then it says, these are the commandments and the ordinances that Hashem commanded through Moses to the children of Israel in the plains of Moab at the Jordan by Jericho, right on the cusp of crossing the Jordan and going into Jericho. So what just happened? So we've heard of the daughters, or many people have heard of the daughters of Zelophehad. The daughters of Zelophehad were from the tribe of Manasseh. Who was Manasseh? It was not one of the sons of Jacob. Manasseh was a grandson of Jacob. Manasseh was the son of Joseph. Okay. This is very important. So what happens is the daughters of Zelophehad, we're actually not going to focus on them. We're going to backtrack this story and see, why is this the culminating story? Why is this the big finale? Why should we all be standing and cheering here that the children of Joseph have the land, and they're going to keep it within their family so that there will be no difficulty with them having access to their tribal inheritance. The daughters of Zelophehad come to Moshe previously and say, we're all daughters. Our father died for his own sin, and if the inheritance rights go through the father, which is how it works according to Jewish law for the land, we're going to be left with nothing, and it's not that we think we're going to be poor, because we'll get married and we'll be under with our, that's how it was, and they'll be under their husbands and they'll have food and water and everything to be taken care of. So it wasn't financial. It's like the land, the possession, the land of Israel, what could be more precious than that, is going to escape us. So we can hear this already in echo, that you had the children of Israel who were complaining with the sin of the spies. They don't want to go into the land of Israel. And now we have the daughters of Zelophehad who are concerned that because of the technicality of the law, that they're going to forfeit land in the land of Israel. And this pains them enough to come to Moshe personally to say, isn't there something that we can do? And then the halacha comes down from God to Moshe to tell the daughters of Zelophehad, the daughters of Zelophehad are right. If there are only daughters, the daughters inherit. The daughters inherit. But now there's going to be another little bit of a problem. And that is the children from the tribe of Manasseh, because the Zelophehad was from the tribe of Manasseh. They are going to say, well, what happens when these Zelophehad daughters, or any other daughters, when they're only daughters, if they inherit land and they go and they get married to someone from another tribe, that land from their tribe is going to go end up with the land of another tribe, and after a while, the tribe of Manasseh's land is going to be whittled away. And then the halacha comes down, you are right, that's true. So what happens is, in this situation, if a daughter is the inheritor of land in the land of Israel, because there were only daughters and no sons in the family, she must marry. She can marry anyone she wants, but it has to be somebody from the tribe that she is from, so that the land stays within the tribal affiliation. Now, you could say, well, that's not fair. What if she doesn't like someone from that tribe? The tribes were huge. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. This isn't like me, you know, when I was dating, saying, there's no one here in this youth group that I like. You know, there wasn't like 9 people. There are thousands of people. And just as an aside, my mother said, well, you need to meet some people from Beth Joseph. There's some very nice kids. And I'm like, oh, why would I like anyone from Beth Joseph? So P.S., that's my husband's from Beth Joseph. So, okay. But only found him because his family came to Road of Shalom so I could meet him. But it was kind of the joke of the family. It's like, why would I like anyone from Beth Joseph? Anyway, it's kind of funny. Beit Yosef from the house of Joseph. Why would I like anyone from there? Ah, so. All right. So that was the halacha. That's the way it was worked, to keep the land in the tribe. But why is Menasha? Why does this come from Menasha? And what is going on here? So what we want to do is understand what is happening with the land, but more so what's happening with the people, and why the tribe of Menasha and the tribe of Joseph. The fact that there are tribes from Joseph tells us something about what has happened now within the Jewish people. Because if we go way back to Genesis, what almost happened to the tribe of Joseph? What almost happened to Joseph himself?
He would have been lost.
He was really lost, and then he was found. Because what happened? Why was he almost lost?
His brothers
sold him. And that was only a step down from their original plan, which was to kill him. The fact that there is a tribe of Joseph, the fact that there is a tribe of Joseph amongst the Jewish people that is part of the Jewish people, means that something good has happened. There has been a correction. There has been a tikkun. There has been a repair of the relationship between the brothers, between Joseph and his brothers. And that's what we're going to explore today. Okay.
Does this have anything to do also with the fact Manasseh stays on the other side of Jordan with the other two tribes, and to keep Israel connected, because we have 2.5 tribes on one side and 8, I'm not adding.
Yeah, and 10.5.
And Manasseh was the obvious one to keep, because Joseph had 2 tribes, and
right,
to keep Israel connected.
Okay, that's a great understanding. So Joseph had 2 sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And half of Manasseh is assigned to stay on the other side. There's lots of understandings about why. One of them is that the tribe of Manasseh was known for their Torah scholars. It said that they would need that the tribes that stayed on the other side of the Jordan would need to have good, strong schools, Torah schools, in order to keep their identity strong. Otherwise, they would assimilate. And also that if there was half of a tribe, that because family likes to see each other, it would guarantee the social connections also between all the tribes. Manasseh was the bridge. Okay, Manasseh is the bridge here. Peggy.
Why it was divided into 2, Joseph's portion, Manasseh and Ephraim, is the other?
Ephraim.
Why don't we know what happened?
So he's counted in with the other tribes. That's part of it. It's just Manasseh is getting a lot of attention here. Manasseh, because of the daughters of Zelophehad. But we're going to go back and see that Manasseh's tribe gets other attention as well. And for that, we want to go to the Parsha from last week, from the Parsha of Matot. Matot is on, where we're going to look at it, is on page 915. Page 915, verse 39. So we read this last week. Often, very often, Parsha Matot and Maaseh are read together. It's one of the double portions. This year, because it's a leap year, the portions are separated because we have an extra month to divide all our parshas into. But Matot and Maaseh usually go together. So they're often looked at together. So let's look at, and Peggy, why don't you read for us verse 39, the children of Machir.
The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and occupied it and drove out the Amorite who were in it.
And continue.
Moses gave Gilead to Machir, son of Manasseh, and he settled in it.
Continue on.
Jair, son of Manasseh, went and occupied their villages and called them
Havot Jair. Okay, great.
Noah went and occupied Anath and her suburbs and called it Nabah after his name.
Okay. The part we're going to look at is the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and occupied it, drove out the Amorite who were in it. Moses gave the Gilead to Machir, son of Manasseh, and he settled in it. Yair, son of Manasseh, went and occupied their villages and called them Chavot Yair. Now, again, this is like any other time when I've read this, it's been like, whatever. You know, there's just some verses in the Torah you just like don't really pay so much attention to. That would be one of them, or several of them. Those would be them. It's like, so what? It sounds like trivial, incidental information. Why do I need to know about this person, about Machir, son of Manasseh, who goes to Gilead? What do I care about Gilead? And what do I need to know about that whole thing? So this is one thing we need to know. First of all, it identifies that Machir is the son of Manasseh, who goes to Gilead. There is another book of Tanakh called Chronicles. And in Chronicles, it lists a whole bunch of information, but part of it are the family trees. It's genealogy. So genealogy that's listed there, sometimes it's interesting because it'll give you a different story than genealogy that was listed in the Torah. And so it calls our attention. So if one were to go to Chronicles and look up this person here, Yair, who is going to be the one who settles in this area, in Gilead, we'll find out that he is not the son of Manasseh. He's not the son of Machir, who's from the tribe of Manasseh. In fact, this is the lineage. So you say, okay, I'm really listening. Try to listen to this. It says, who is Yair really? He is from the tribe of Yehuda. Okay, it says Yehuda, Judah, it gives the whole chronology, gives birth to Peretz. Peretz gives birth to Hetzron. Hetzron marries a granddaughter of Manasseh. They have a child who then has a child named Yair. So what is Yair's connection to the tribe of Manasseh? Through which side? His grandmother. His grandmother is from the tribe of Manasseh. But he, tribal identification goes through the tribe of, through the father. He is from the tribe of Yehuda. But the Torah is very clearly telling us the children of Machir, son of Manasseh. Okay, so why is it saying that? So it is true, Machir is the son, is from the tribe of Manasseh. But Yair, this next person on the next page, verse 41, son of Manasseh or child of Manasseh, is not descended from Manasseh, is descended from Yehuda. Okay? So now we have a situation. It's like, why is it different? Why doesn't it tell us his real identity? And why does it make a point to tell us this grandmother identity as if it was his patrilineal identity? It's giving us his matrilineal identity. And we also have something interesting to notice because it's from the tribe of Yehuda, is where he's really from, but he's being credited as if he's really from from the house of Joseph. Because remember, Manasseh is a child of Joseph. So anytime we say Manasseh, we're really talking about Joseph. But he's really from the tribe of Yehuda. What do we know about Joseph and Yehuda, the original people? I'm sorry?
Yehuda was going to train him. He was talking to Joseph about Benjamin.
Ah, about Benjamin. But what was Yehuda's original intention for Joseph? It was Yehuda who's the one who said, let's sell him.
Not kill him.
Yeah, he said, don't kill him, but let's sell him. Yehuda is held responsible for that because he was the leader of his brothers. It says, had they said, had Yehuda said, don't touch him, bring him back to the father, like we're doing the wrong thing, they would have listened to him. Yehuda has a huge mark on himself, which is the mark of being the one who suggests selling Joseph. It's considered a tremendous betrayal. He's the one who leads the betrayal. Because you could say, well, the person who says to kill, that person may be passionate and on an anger trip or whatever. But Yehuda should have been the one to say, don't do anything to him. He's the one who says to sell him. So Yehuda has what to go through, teshuva to go through, because he's willing to betray his own brother. That gets corrected, however. And when does it get corrected? It gets corrected with what Gabi said is later, after Joseph goes down to Egypt, becomes second in command, and the brothers all come down, and Joseph frames them and frames Benjamin, hides the goblet in Benjamin's sack in order to bring the brothers back. And Yehuda is the one then who's going to be the one to say, take me and let Benjamin go back to his father. And what's so hard about this for Yehuda altogether is because Yehuda's mother was Leah. Benjamin and Joseph's mother is Rachel. What does Yehuda have to acknowledge when he is willing to trade his life for Benjamin's life?
That he messed up with Joseph one time.
That he messed up with Joseph is one time, is one major thing, and something else he has to acknowledge personally in his own family. That they're all brothers,
well, and
that Rachel, that his father would rather have Benjamin alive and with him than himself, Yehuda. Ouch. My mother loved Rachel more than my mother. I'm sorry, my father loved loves his mother more than my mother. Ouch. And this is what he does, like, I don't care, we're all brothers. I don't care, we're all brothers. I will sacrifice my life. Now, being a slave, when he gives his life over to Joseph, at that time he thinks Joseph is second in command. He doesn't know that all this is going to be a charade and all of this is going to be revealed and everyone will be united. At that point, he's really willing to give his life. And when he pledges to his father, send Benjamin down with me, I will vouch for him. I will be the surety for him. I will be the collateral for him. With that, he is willing to give his life for his brother. He says, that is what the Jewish people hinges on, is one Jewish person being willing to give their life for another Jewish person. Regardless of all the baggage, regardless of my mother was the more favorite, the less favorite, you would rather have him alive than me alive. I don't care. We're all in this together. At this point, it doesn't matter. There is a higher truth that everyone gets to. Getting to that place of higher truth is where the Jewish people succeed. So now we're going to go back and see another layer where the name is going to tell us something about what's going on here. If we go back to... Yes, I'm sorry, Valerie.
Judas is the one that said to sell him, not kill him. Who wanted to kill him?
I think it was... was it Reuven? Let's go back to it. It was in Vayeshev. Let's find it. We need to answer that question. Hold on. Let's find that of who wants to. No, it's in Bereishit. It is in Bereishit, and it was who wants to kill. No, Reuven said shed no blood, but the people didn't listen to Reuven. No one listens to Reuven. He was very weak. They all wanted to kill him. They all wanted to kill him. Reuven hears, it's on page 203, then top of page 205. Reuven said, don't shed blood, throw him into the pit, but don't lay a hand on him. Then they sit down and eat food. And then Judas says later in verse 27, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Okay, just put your hand on that page and just keep it there while we go back to Matot. So keep it on page 205 and then go back to page 915. All right, verse 39. Now we're going to look at this again. So now we already know that this person, Yair, it's a little twisty in the mouth, who's the son of Machir, Okay, he's related to Machir, a child, a descendant of Machir. Ah, but it means a descendant of Menashe, because it's not a direct son. Menashe has long been gone by this time. But look now at verse 39. The children of Machir, and then instead of saying son of, just child, children, descendant of Menashe, went to Gilead. Okay, went to Gilead, and this is going to be what's important for us. And it's the place is called Gilead. And occupied it, drove out the Amorite, and this becomes a place where, on the next page, Yair, son of Menashe, and we know Yair is really not a descendant on his father's side from Menashe. Yair is a descendant from Yehuda. Okay, but in this case, Yair represents the unification of both the tribe of Yehuda and Joseph through Menashe, and his name is Yair. What does Yair mean? It means to illuminate, from the word or. Okay, means to illuminate. There's going to be an illumination that is brought to this place called Gilead. Now, go back now to page 205 and go up to verse 25. There. And Pam, if you could read verse 25 for us on page 205.
They sat to eat food. They raised their eyes and they saw, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead. Their camels bearing spices, balsam, and lotus on their way to bring them down to Egypt.
Okay. Then Yehuda's going to make his statement right at this point here. And again, why don't you read that for us?
Judah said to his brothers, what gain will there be if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. But let our hand not be upon him, for he is our brother. Our own flesh.
It's a little interesting and ironic that he calls him our own brother in our own flesh, so we'll just sell him. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And where are the Ishmaelites coming from? They're coming from Gilead. Okay. He says, this place where these Ishmaelites come from is another echo, is hearkening back to Gilead. This place has a problem for us. This place of Gilead is a place that needs to be fixed up, and it needs to be fixed up by somebody who is from the tribe of Yehuda, because it is these Ishmaelites from Gilead who are now going to be the vehicles for the selling of Joseph to them. Okay, so this is Gilead. But Gilead appears even earlier. So now we're going to go back further in Bereshit, and we're going to go to Parsha Vayetze on page 163.
This is big drama.
It's very big drama. It's so big that it's all hidden. It's like, where are things that are really, really big hidden in the most... It's like, when you want to hide your jewelry, where do you hide it? Yes, exactly. You hide it. You don't hide it in the box that says, "Here's my jewelry." Okay, you hide it in a place where no one would look. Okay, but everyone looks there, right? Because they're like, "Oh, they hid it under wardrobe." So now we know where her jewelry is. Okay. So you always hide the most precious, amazing things in places that seem the most nothing. So here we're hiding it in a name called Yair, Ben Menashe, except. Haha, he's not really from Menashe, he's really from Yehuda, but this is going to be a bringing together of Menashe from Joseph and Yehuda, and there was already a problem having to do with Gilead, that's where the Ishmaelites had been, and that's who they end up selling Yosef to, the big betrayal of the Jewish people. But this place is a place that already has a problem for us. So let's go to, I said page 163, Parsha Vayetze, yes, Eileen.
This weekend, a bunch of us saw Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat at the Space Needle. And so it was just perfect because I feel like I understand more now what you're saying because I didn't know much about it. But he's portrayed as being this really loving, kind, amicable, sweet character.
Joseph?
Was he in fact that?
He was.
Okay, Joseph.
Yeah, Joseph was.
So was he betrayed by his brothers because his mother was loved more and he was a favorite child, or because of his prophecy, or both?
Not because he was a child of Rachel, but because he was a favorite child and because of his prophecy, which seemed to make it be that he was going to be lording over his brothers.
Right, that he would
Yeah.
And he, the arrogance, they thought that he was going to be a splinter group. So that's a whole other separate discussion. They thought they were doing the right thing by getting rid of him.
They felt threatened.
They felt threatened from him, and there's some understanding to say that they felt justifiably threatened.
Right.
But not because he was a bad person, but because they misunderstood what Joseph was saying, and that Joseph also was too young for his prophecy. He hadn't grown into it, and so it was like, hey guys, look what I dreamt. You know, I'm going to be ruling over you. Isn't that crazy? Like, he didn't handle it.
That's how it was portrayed in the play, was that he was innocent, like a child. Like he said, you guys, I had this dream, and then the brothers are aghast, and he's like, wow, isn't that a cool dream? But anyway, I would highly recommend it. It was incredible.
Is that the family?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was, and if you take 9-10 people all together, the tickets are almost half price.
Great.
It's fabulous.
Thank you. And now we're going to go back to, even before the selling of Joseph, we need to go to something even earlier on. So ladies, let's continue on page 163 at the bottom of the page. We're going to look at verse 19. And Rachel, would you like to read for us verses 19, 20, and 21?
Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole the terephim that belonged to her father. Jacob deceived Laban and the Aramean by not telling him that he was free. Thus he fled with all he had. He arose and crossed over the river, and he set his direction toward Mount Gilead.
Okay. Here we are again, Har HaGilad. And it's called HaGilad, not just Gilad, like the Gilad. Now we're going to go down. We're going to skip a moment to look at something because we want to understand what Gilad is. Laban is going to chase after Jacob for leaving with his daughters and with their children and with their things, because Jacob senses that Laban is really going to start being out to get him, and he flees and he's ready to go. Laban knows that Jacob is the source of blessing to all of his wealth, and he's also an evil person, and he doesn't want Jacob to leave, and he chases after him. Susan. This is what we're going to take a look at right now. And Susan, I will have you look at it here. And we're going to look at it in two places here. If you look at verse 45 on the bottom of page 167. 167, verse 45 and 46.
Then Jacob took a stone and raised it up as a monument. And Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. So they took stones and made a mound.
Okay, so in the Hebrew, that mound is called a gal. Okay, vayasu gal, vayochlu sham al hagal. They made a mound, a gal, vayochlu, and they ate there al hagal, on the gal. And this is going to be a place where, now if you look in verses 47 and 48, we will continue. Kathy, do you want to continue on verses 47 and 48?
Laban called it.
Whatever he called it. Okay. Shahaduta, whatever.
But Jacob called it.
Sahaduta.
Gal-Ed. And Laban declared, this mound is a witness between me and you today. Therefore, he called it its name
Gal-Ed. Okay, that is what it means. Gal means a mound, and aid is a witness. Okay, an edut means testimony. It gives a witness. So an aid is a witness, like on a marriage contract or on any kind of document, an aid. That means that this is a mound of testimony, a mound of witnessing. And this witnessing is going to be between Jacob and Laban. Now, Laban is the one who comes, and he's going to accuse Jacob of stealing from him and of being a crook and being outrageous, and he has all of these false accusations against Jacob. However, there's one thing that he accuses him of that is true. And what does he accuse Jacob of doing? So he accuses someone in Jacob's party of taking taking Laban's gods, taking his idols. And Jacob says, he makes a very firm statement here. So hold on one second. We want to see what he says to you. Hold on one second. I kept losing it.
51 again.
It's 167, I think it's 36.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I think it starts at 67, 36, and then on.
Yes, but then it is, I want to see where he says about the,
yeah,
I'm sorry?
39.
I don't know why I kept losing this. This is where he responds to him, but where is it?
Well, in 36, he became angered and he says, what is my transgression?
Ah, okay, here, actually, I want to go back to, first we want to do verses 31 and 32. So let's take a look at that. And Eileen, do you want to read verses 31 and 32 on page 165?
Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, is it Laban?
Yes, Laban.
Mm-hmm,
or Laban.
Because I was afraid, for I thought, perhaps you might steal your daughters from me. With whomever you find your gods, he shall not live in the presence of our kinsmen.
Ascertain.
For yourself. You don't read aloud except on Pesach.
I know, class, that's
so
right.
Okay. Ascertain for yourself what is truth with me and take it back. Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen him.
Okay, but Jacob makes a very strong statement. What does he say to Laban about the teraphim? What does he promise?
Whoever you find these with, they'll die.
They'll die.
And he, you know. Yeah.
Okay, and he didn't know that Rachel had taken. He was so outraged. And so indignant of being accused of taking anything because Jacob is called the master of truth and honesty, despite what you read in the newspapers. Okay, he was a master of truth and honesty, and he was outraged that anyone would accuse him of doing anything. So much so that he says, anyone who took it will die. Now, he didn't know that Rachel had taken them. And Rachel may have taken them for a good reason, but she still took them. The words out of a righteous person's mouth becomes a curse. It can also become a blessing. This curse is understood by our sages, and Rashi quotes it as the reason for Rachel dying in childbirth with Benjamin, that she had to die. So this death coming from this curse is, but the loss of Rachel, to lose Rachel, if you really wanted to lose Rachel, who else would Jacob have to lose in addition to Rachel? If you're going to really lose Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. You would have to really lose the whole kit and caboodle. You would have to lose Joseph and Benjamin. And does Jacob lose Joseph in any way, shape, or form? For 22 years. And does he lose Benjamin? He almost does. But he's rescued at the last minute by Yehuda. So the Yehuda is the one who is going to correct and undo the curse at Gilad. Undo the curse of what was said at Gilad between Laban and Jacob about the one who is this person, who the one who your teraphim are with will die. It's like that almost came true. It came really, really close to coming true, because the story could have turned out any number of different ways, and it was fast approaching the way of turning out where Jacob would have lost everyone. Had Yehuda not done what he did, there would have been a complete and forever severing of the Jewish people at that point. And the tribes, the family would have been broken. Who knows how that would have worked out. This happens in Gilad. And the place that is here, Laban makes the most bizarre oath. And let's take a look at that, because it kind of reminds me of some peace treaties that have been offered the Jewish people. Of like, you Jacob the aggressor, now we're going to have a peace treaty. It's like, I never did anything. So first of all, let's read what Jacob says about how he didn't do anything and only did good. And this might be a familiar story of the Jewish people throughout history. Whatever country they have lived in have only done good to the countries they have been in. Countries imported them as if they were a service to bolster their economy when they needed them. The Turks, for example, imported the Jewish people in order to have them there to bolster their economy. And then they turn around and flip on us. So Laban flips on Jacob, and this is what Jacob answers him. So let's take a look when Jacob gets really angry. And putting aside the teraphim, which he didn't know about and may have been done for their own reasons, but let's take a look starting at verse 38 here. And let's see, who would like to read verse? Someone who would like to read Jacob's speech in a real compelling way. Stell, why don't you go for it? Verses 38 through 42.
These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I eat rams of your flock. That which was mangled I never brought you. I myself would bear the loss. From me you would exact it, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. This is how I was. By day, scorching heat consumed me, and frost by night. My sleep drifted from my eyes. This is my 20 years in your household. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wage 100 times. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the dread of Isaac been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. God saw my wretchedness and the toil of my hands, so he admonished you last night.
Well, he was angry.
Yeah.
This was, not only didn't Jacob steal from him, even the things, it's like the normal course of business when you're a shepherd. If you have animals that are mangled by wild animals, the shepherd is not held accountable. Jacob, he ate the losses himself. He substituted from his own flocks to make up what was lost from his father-in-law's flocks. Anything, he stayed awake day and night, away from his family, guarding his flocks to make sure that Laban would prosper. And Laban has the audacity to come to him to accuse him. So Laban then is going to make, okay, now he's going to make this big peace treaty with Jacob. So, and Laban declares on verse 48, and Valerie, why don't you pick it up here, page 169, verse 48 through 53.
And Laban declared, this mound is a witness between me and you today. Therefore he called his name Galeed. As for the Mizpah, because he said, may Hashem keep watch between me and you when we are out of each other's sight.
I just ask you, who has some more to worry about here? God is going to keep watch of you, Jacob, when we're out of sight, when you're out of sight from me. Go ahead.
If you will ill-treat my daughters, or if you will marry wives in addition to my daughters.
That's a threat. That's why it's dash, dash, dash.
Though no man may be among us, but see, God is a witness between me and you. And Laban said to Jacob, here is this mound, and here is the monument which I have cast between me and you. This mound shall be witness, and the monument shall be witness that I may not cross over to you past this mound, nor may you cross over to me past this mound and this monument for evil. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor judge between us, the God of their father. And Jacob swore by the dread of his father Isaac.
Okay. This is as if Jacob were going to be out to do harm to Laban. Bless you. However, what I would like to suggest here is that really what this Galeed is going to be is Laban is setting up. This is also, they made an agreement here. This mound is going to be a witness to Jacob and his family. And it's going to witness whether there is wrongdoing in the family or not. Not really, quite frankly, having anything to do with Laban, but within the Jewish people themselves. It's like, we now have a witness. God is going to be watching this family. And if the family is mistreating one another, God will be the witness of this. It's like, indeed, Galeed is the witness. Because then, not so much longer, after this, we're going to have the Ishmaelites from Galeed bearing witness to the brothers' betrayal of one another, and then it's not going to be until, and then it's going to be partially redeemed with Yehuda, who is going to redeem and stand up for Benjamin, but that becomes an action just one-on-one. It doesn't necessarily speak to the entire people, but then we're going to see 30, 40 years after that, which is already hundreds of years later, because we have Jacob and his family, and we know that they were in Egypt for 210 years. And then we have another 40 years after that. So 250 years later, we have Galeed. We're going to have this place before we cross into the land of Israel, before we cross the Jordan. What is the status of this family? Are they ready to go in or not? What's the best way for the Jewish people to be ready to go in? Is unity between them. If they're all together, if the brothers are together, the tribes are united, and all for one and one for all, then you can cross the Jericho, I'm sorry, you can cross the Jordan River, then you can go into the land of Israel, and then you will be able to prevail. That is going to be the determining factor. And where do we see that, in fact, it does happen? We see it in this nondescript description that Yair, the son of Machir, the descendant of Machir from the tribe of Joseph. Now, I ask you also, what does the word Machir mean?
To sell.
To sell. This child from the tribe of Joseph was named Machir. The selling, hearkening back, why would you name your child sell? Okay? To sell is about, the selling of Joseph. Has that been fixed or not? Did it stay fixed? Yes, it was a wonderful move on the part of Yehuda. But what about all these years later? What is the state of the Jewish people? Is one willing to give their life for the other? Do they see themselves as if they were one? I don't care if it's on my grandmother's side, I'm from the tribe of Joseph, and on my father's side, I'm from the tribe of Yehuda. Have Yehuda and Yosef, have they been reconciled? I tried to sell you. I did sell you. Did that get fixed? Yair comes along, and where does he go? Specifically to this place, Gilad. This is the place that must be not only militarily secured, thank you, not only militarily secured, it had to be spiritually secured as well. It's like Yair from the tribe representing Manasseh and Yosef and descendant of Yehuda, he comes to illuminate that place and secure it, and Moshe gives that land to that family. They get it, and the Jewish people then are secured, and then they can truly say, Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek. It was always that story, is like that Gal-Ed, that place that was going to be a testimony, a witness to the Jewish people. And it's almost as if Laban is articulating words of God, because Laban himself surely has no cause for articulating that challenge to the Jewish people. Laban, Yaakov never did one thing to Laban and only did good. But God may have something to say to the Jewish people, saying, this mound will be a witness, and it's going to see of what's your family going to be? How are they going to get along? And before the journey is over, before the Torah is over, before you cross into the land of Israel, I need to be a witness to see, are you all together or not? Is one willing to give his life for the other or not? With this battle at Gal-Ed and establishing the cities of Gal-Ed, and Yair representing this coming together of both Manasseh from Joseph and Yehuda, we see that the Jewish people are truly ready to cross the Jordan, go into the land of Israel, and fight the battles that will need to be fought in order to secure the land. We find ourselves in the exact same situation today. There's a Gal-Ed. There's a mound. There's a witness. It's like, God is watching us. You know that Judy Collins song, whatever? God is watching. I don't know if she wrote it. She sang it really beautifully. I'm sorry?
The one about from a distance?
From a distance. God, except God is not watching from such a distance. Up close and personal. It says, God never takes his eyes off the land of Israel. He never closes his eyes on the land of Israel. God is watching us. Are we together or not? Is there a unity or not? That will be the only thing that will qualify and determine whether the Jewish people will be able to live in their land in peace. If we go also back to the end of, to Matot, where it says there, on page 916, and it says, and he settled in it, Vayeshev Ba. That's the word that's used for the settling of the land of Israel, is the Yishuv. It means to be able to sit, means able to be yoshev. It means to be able, not lagur, which means to dwell. That means you went there for a while. But leshev means you sit there and you're established and you can be in a place in peace. And that is considered a fulfillment of the prophecy. It's not enough just to be there. Can you sit there? Can you sit there in peace? So we say yoshev, it means also to sit. It means not to have to be at the ready, but can you sit and can you dwell in peace? And that this becomes both a conclusion of the Torah of the narrative, as well as a direction for us of we have to go through the same test that the Jewish people went through at that time. The Torah is our marching orders. They tell us what it is we need to accomplish in our own journey. And if we can come to this place, then we will have success. There was Janice.
The map that you showed us at the beginning, does it show where Gilead is?
You know, I didn't look at it carefully enough to see. And the truth is, it's going to be not far from the Jordan. The Jordan River. It's not going to be far from the Jordan River.
Gilead is above Jericho on the Israel side. So you're saying that the original was in what is now Jordan?
Correct. On the other side. On the other side of the Jordan.
So there's a different modern Gilead?
There may be. Not all the places are exactly the same. For our purposes, what's the most important is to know what it represents spiritually, that there is a Gal-Ed, that there is a place that is a witness to what we are doing, and that we can't pretend like nothing is happening and that this is what's going on. Patricia and Peggy. And actually, we're going to have to go soon because there is an event at the Jewish Experience now. Rabbi Ken Spiro is live from Jerusalem giving an update on what's going on in Israel. They're waiting for us.
It just didn't seem like that long after they settled that the 10 tribes were lost.
It was actually pretty
long after.
Yeah, it was pretty long after.
So, okay.
Yeah, but yes, they were lost, but they'll be back. Don't worry. And it's more important that the ones who are left and the tribes, what we have to mostly worry about. What's interesting is the Jewish people who are alive today are from the tribe of Yehuda. That's why we're called Yehudim, Jewish people, and the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, because Benjamin and Yehuda were together. We are mostly Yehudaites, Judas, and Binyamin from the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Levi because they were interspersed throughout the land of Israel.
Is this right?
That's who the Jewish people are today, the known Jews. The 10 lost tribes, they're still lost, and hopefully God will find them at the right time and they will come back. We'll be like, you're Jewish? Like, you don't look Jewish? Okay, so we'll find them all. God willing, we'll end this parsha. Just so you know, we are now going to be on a summer break where, God willing, my children will get here from Israel, and we will be resuming on Thursday, August 21st. I'll look forward to seeing you then. We will be getting ready to start Rosh Chodesh Elul soon after that to launch our preparation for the high holidays. I can't believe it's almost Rosh Hashanah. So have a wonderful Shabbos, and just send out those vibes of the Jewish people, Am Yisrael Chai, and the Jewish people need to be united as a nation. I'm sorry I couldn't take the rest of your questions. I just promised. I'm sorry? Yes, but that each individual airline can make their own decision. Delta. How many did we have? 1, 2, 3. Yes.